The Schizophrenic 60s, Television, Part 3, Science Fiction. This will be The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, and Star Trek. The Twilight Zone premiered on CBS on October the 2nd, 1959. You're traveling through another dimension, a dimension not of only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. The signpost up ahead, your next stop, the Twilight Zone. Writer Rod Serling created television's granddaddy of science fiction thrillers because of his frustration with sponsors tampering with his scripts for the esteemed dramatic series Playhouse 90. One sponsor, an automaker, demanded that the Chrysler building be painted out of a scene. Another, a tobacco company, deleted the word Lucky from a script because Lucky Strikes weren't their brand. When an insurance company refused to allow a central character to commit suicide, Serling quit. He created a fantasy thriller that was not a smash hit in the 6 years it ran in originals, but that acquired a cult following that became a classic of its genre. Serling began writing after World War II and in the 50s won 3 Emmys, one for his 1955 play Patterns about ambition and big business, a second a year later, the Requiem for a Heavyweight, and the third, 1957, for The Comedian, and he would win 3 more for The Twilight Zone. Listeners hung on his resonant voice, which opened each episode with a chilling promise of unexpected eeriness to come. There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, between the pit of man's fears and the sunlight of his knowledge. The scripts were as literate as the opening, and of his writing, Serling once said, quote, "Style is something for you to develop by copying the style of someone who writes well. For a while, you're a cheap imitation. I was a Hemingway imitator," end of quote. Though not for long, soon others were copying Serling's style. Each show's ending was a guaranteed shocker. In People Are All Alike, All Over, the first Earthman to visit Mars, Roddy McDowell, discovers that Martians are even more hospitable than Earthlings. They build him an exact replica of his Earth home, furnish it in the same style, feed him well. Then he discovers the doors are locked. Parting the curtains, he sees a crowd of Martians gazing at him, then glimpses a sign, quote, "Earth creature in native habitat," end of quote. In addition to the series acquiring a cult following, its title slipped into the American idiom. The phrase Twilight Zone became synonymous with a state of the unknown. In the early 60s, the Secretary of State Dean Rusk spoke of the Twilight Zone of international relations. Renowned boxer Archie Moore said of a punch that flattened him, quote, "Man, I was in the Twilight Zone," end of quote. And in the next decade, following the death of Mao Zedong, editorialists wrote the Twilight Zone of Chinese-American relations. Serling often boasted of writing an original Twilight Zone script in under 35 hours, and he rarely used a typewriter, preferring to dictate the contents of his imagination onto a tape recorder. When Twilight Zone went off the air in 1964, Serling wrote screenplays for movies like Planet of the Apes, and in the fall of 1970 introduced a new TV series, Rod Serling's Night Gallery, which dealt more with the occult than with science fiction. 5 years later, at age 50, he died from complications following open-heart surgery, entering, as he himself liked to say, the ultimate Twilight Zone. The series remained the best science fiction anthology ever created for television. The Outer Limits, ABC, September 16, 1963. In the 80s, television would be criticized for its Disease of the Week programming. In the 60s, it was adored by fans for its Monster of the Week, most notably found in ABC's high-budget, imaginative special effects, hour-long science thriller, The Outer Limits. The show began with the image on your screen suddenly going haywire, and a firm voice saying, "There's nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. You are about to experience the awe and mystery that leads you from the inner mind to the outer limits." That's just absolutely incredible. And actually, a lot of these shows on the outer limits play well, even in a modern time, on the type of topic they were covering. At any rate, the show and its weekly roster of creatures debuted just as television viewers were about to go crazy over sitcom monster families like the Addams Family and the Munsters. Mid-decade, monsters were big business. They even featured in pop songs and dance crazes like Monster Mash. The Outer Limits was originally titled Please Stand By, but with its scrambled picture opening and Big Brother voiceover, TV executives, especially following the tensions created by the Cuban Missile Crisis and the threat of World War III, that unsuspecting viewers might flip to the channel and react to it as in Orson Welles' War of the Worlds kind of panic. In fact, the show's creator, Leslie Stevens, as a high school student, had sold a play to Welles' Mercury Theater and talked himself into a job with the company. The show's co-writer, Joseph Stefano, had written the screenplay for Hitchcock's thriller Psycho. The talent behind Outer Limits was abundant, the scripts highly original and literate. The monster of the week served as a metaphor for human foibles. Whereas The Twilight Zone elicited from viewers a shudder and a smile, its ABC competitors strive for hair-raising terror. No Outer Limits episode was filmed for less than $150,000, and special effects were often state-of-the-art scary. Many of the most memorable of the show's 49 episodes were by Stefano. In The Invisibles, a group of supremely intelligent extraterrestrials, resembling slimy slugs, attached themselves to human by eating into the host's spinal column. An operation filmed in shudderingly graphic detail. No expense was spared for gore. Outer Limits scored higher viewer ratings until TV executives foolishly moved it from Mondays to Saturdays, where it fell opposite the popular Jackie Gleason show. It lost its following and was subsequently telecast for the last time on January the 16th, 1965. It remains a landmark in television for cinematography and special effects that approached those typically found in high-budget feature films of the day. As the 60s obsession with science fiction progressed, undoubtedly the preeminent example would debut in 1966 with Star Trek. But let me mention something about the Outer Limits. I watched one show where they have, the Earth is keeping these criminals from another planet, but they're gigantic ants, and they escape and then will attack people. And I tell you what, it was so scary that for years, I wouldn't go into any room unless I reached around and turned the light on first. So and you can find Outer Limits for free on YouTube and other places. So let's go to Star Trek now. Star Trek premiered September the 8th, 1966. In a scholarly essay, Science Fiction and Fantasy TV, Mark Stegall argues that in Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek, humans often encounter races technologically superior to themselves, but they prove victorious because of their values as are well adapted to the life on the frontier. Like their American pioneer forebears, they are scrappy, persistent, resourceful, and quick to adapt. While the crew is a mixture of races, character is obviously American. Roddenberry in the early 60s also saw strong similarities between American space exploration and the experience of the country's pioneers, and he based his idea on a sci-fi trek to the stars on a Western called Wagon Train, and referred to the idea as a wagon train to the stars. The pilot episode, entitled The Cage, cost an extraordinary $630,000 to film and featured only two members of the final cast, Leonard Nimoy and Majel Barrett. NBC hated it and requested a second pilot, which was audaciously titled Where No Man Had Gone Before, and which included such characters as American Captain James Kirk, half-Vulcan, half-human Mr. Spock, with charming logic of his own. British Commonwealth systems engineer Scotty and Japanese navigator Sulu. NBC moved it to the fall schedule and number one cult TV show of all time was born, as any Trekkie would vouch. Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York, admitted it was his favorite show. Writer Isaac Asimov said it was the only television show he watched. Fan clubs formed across the nation. Trekkies gathered and still do for conventions. They circulate newsletters, even though in original episodes, of which there are 78, the series had been off the air since September the 2nd, 1969. President Gerald Ford in 1976 named the country's first reusable orbiting space shuttle the Enterprise in honor of the spaceship on the show. A stickler for scientific accuracy, Roddenberry consulted experts in space science and medicine to make sure that every aspect of the Enterprise was credible. Indeed, the creation was so good that the Navy later expressed an interest in plans for the starship's landing deck, and the NASA doctors were interested in the craft's diagnostic beds and sick bay. Roddenberry's creation spawned the cottage industry of Star Trek products, from Spock ears, phaser guns, bubblegum cards, school lunch boxes, and the like, and feature films. Not bad for a show that was canceled after only 3 seasons. An NBC decision that resulted in the network offices being deluged with over 1 million pieces of protest mail, many threatening executives with bodily harm if they did not reconsider. Truth was, the program of Earth heroes battling futuristic Huns like Klingons and Romulans never ranked in the top 25 shows of a year. Though the show had its zealous fans in the late 60s, it didn't become a true phenomena until it reruns. Star Trek reflects not merely a general perception of American culture, but also particular issues that predominated in the first 4 years of the 1960s. One of those was genuine fear of emerging technology, which was going to obsolete ordinary working people. The show reassured the working American that however he might fear the encroachment of technology on his home and his workplace, man would always triumph because of his peculiar, particularly human qualities. Creator Gene Roddenberry said his show suggested that there is a tomorrow. There's a challenge and a romance in the world. But it also said more. It goes rather like this, Roddenberry wrote. You human biped thing called man, you strange creature, still in a sort of violent childhood of your evolution. You're awkward and even illogical. You're weak, vain, but damn it, you're also gorgeous. End of quote. And of course, I very much like Star Trek. As a matter of fact, when the first Star Wars movie came out, I didn't go see it for a while because I thought, oh, it's never going to be better than Star Trek. Till my wife finally got me to go. And then you watch the first few seconds of the gigantic Star Destroyer going across the screen. And then it's like, oh man, the Enterprise is toast. So it was some really interesting. I have collected Star Trek memorabilia. And I do have one book that is signed by every one of the original cast members. So that's always been kind of fun. Now the source for this, Benotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Obsessions by Charles Benotti. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.